when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down, Buffett.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. He was drunk.
He needs a mirror.
I mean,
oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
In the face of democracy. Very good.
Hello there, I'm Mark Kenny, and welcome to the 200th episode of Democracy Sausage, and the very first one to be recorded before a live audience. What do you think of that? 200 episodes. Pretty good. Can I start by acknowledging the land on which we meet, the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and pay my respects to their elders past and present, and to any First Nations peoples present or listening around the country. Democracy Sausage began in the campaign period in the 2019 election and has continued to grow through the years since, so it seems fairly apt that we should be sitting here doing the 200th episode, reaching this milestone in the 2022 election campaign. Perhaps, arguably, I've said this before, I've said this on the podcast, I think, arguably the most important election we've seen since 1972, which is 50 years. And I'm happy to be tested on that if anyone has a serious objection to it. As usual, we've assembled a great panel for our discussion. First, my friend and regular partner at the Hot Plate, Dr. Maria Taflaga. She's a political scientist, lecturer, and director of the Centre for the Study of Australian Politics. Welcome, Maria.
Hello. Welcome, everyone.
Also along with us, this time for the first time, is Yasmin Poole, an outstanding ANU alumna. She's also a youth advocate. She's a Rhodes Scholar. You've probably seen her on various programs on television, Q&A, The Drum, those kinds of things. And she's therefore a budding political and public intellectual. Yasmin, welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Hey, Mark. Great to be with you.
And finally, in the middle, Ross Solly. He's a former ABC political journalist up in the press gallery where I was at for many years. He's an author and a presenter on ABC Radio, currently in Canberra. Ross, welcome to Democracy Sausage, also for the first time.
Thank you very much, Mark, and congratulations on your 200th episode, which I think a lot of people in the room here were surprised you got past the third one, so well done. Congratulations.
Yeah, I think
I joined after the third one, so
that's when it took a positive turn.
It was on,
I think,
life support at that moment. Yeah. Maria rescued it. That's true. Now, look, tonight after this, there's a far less important debate going on. That is between the two leaders who are meeting face to face on Sky Television in the Sky News Career Mail People's Forum in Brisbane. Maria, let's start with you. What is an election campaign as a political scientist? What is an election campaign, and how important are these kind of set piece, these performative aspects of the campaign that come up? We've got the debates. Obviously, we have the campaign launches. We have these daily sort of press conferences that the leaders do. Are they really changing the way people think about politics or think about the candidates?
So, to disappoint everyone, I think most of the empirical evidence tends to suggest that, that campaigns don't really matter all that much. And in many ways, what campaigns kind of are they're part of the extension of the theatre of politics. But I guess the sort of most basic definition is there's sort of like a formal sort of suspension of parliament, suspension of executive government, you know, government goes into hiatus, and the people get the chance to, I guess, truly focus on the alternative visions for the future that the parties are notionally supposed to offer us. However, you've all been watching the campaign, and you'll probably gather that there isn't that much talk about the future, and that's because much of what governs how campaigns function is really their relationship to technology. So before we had radio, people used to go to rallies, and people used to heckle leaders, and leaders used to be funny because they were heckled all the time, you know. We then went through the age of television, and messages were centralized because that was really efficient for parties. They got fax machines. They could tell everyone to say the same stuff. Before then, you know, there were more rogue elements. And now in the age of social media, we can kind of see that discipline kind of breaking down, and we can see parties effectively trying to kind of micro-target audiences and say one thing to one audience and another to others. And much of this is difficult for us to observe, and we don't always know exactly what the effects of some of these forms of, you know, micro-targeting that are going on. So campaigns probably don't matter because people probably have made up their minds, broadly speaking, but there is always a cohort who do make up their mind in the polling booth, and I guess it matters for them.
Ross, there's a lot of people who haven't made up their minds, as Maria says, in election campaigns. We hear vox pops. I heard a couple as we were driving back here tonight. You know, someone was saying, I think it was on news radio, saying, nope, haven't looked at it at all, don't know who's running, that kind of thing. There are quite a lot of voters who are disengaged from politics on an ongoing basis. But because we have compulsory voting, they have to at some point sort of turn up, and that's one of the strengths of compulsory voting. I guess it's also one of the weaknesses as well, depending on what they do with their vote, how seriously they take it. But I wonder, going off what Maria's saying, is that a concern, for one thing? And secondly, are election campaigns, in a sense, a kind of a potentially high-risk moment for the political candidates? There's not a whole lot to be gained, but a fair bit to be lost, as we saw from the way the Labor leader's unemployment gaffe was reported last week.
Yeah, I think what Maria was saying is right. I think that I'm surprised when people say they still haven't made their mind up. I think if that's the case, they probably have not a lot of interest in politics. Politics has become so divided in Australia. You're either one way or you're the other. There aren't many people who are sort of swaying between one or the other direction. They've become so staged managed now, these election campaigns, that each political party will send out an advance party to make sure that the places they're going to are full of friendly faces.
Well, we all remember that photo of Tony Abbott with reject shop written above him. You know?
And remember
who didn't advance that? Yeah.
And remember when someone didn't tell him that was an onion, and he picked it up and ate it? And because he had to pretend that he does that all the time, now everybody just comes up and gives him onions and says, Tony, I love your work. Here's an onion. Can you chew on this? Oh, my God, not another one. But there was the famous, I think, was it Paul Keating that walked into the wrong pie shop?
Yes.
Because the advance party had gone out and they'd said to him, when we go into this shopping centre, look like you're surprised to be here. And then going to Pete's Pies, because Pete's a big fan and he's going to love you and it's going to be a great opportunity. But unfortunately, he went into Bob's Pies.
Yeah, and Bob wasn't happy.
Bob hated Paul. Bob Hawke hated Paul, and Bob's Pies hated Paul.
Of course, the most celebrated one in recent times was the what was that hotel chain in the US where Trump's campaign went to?
And the former mayor of New
Rudy,
York,
Rudy Giuliani,
yes. Hasn't he gone well? Rudy stood outside what he thought was going to be a hotel, and it turned out to be a dumpster place.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that's just crazy that could happen in this day and age. But to go back to your question, there's very little chance now that politicians are going to come across real people who have real concerns. And that's why the other night when Scott Morrison was in the pub in Newcastle, when a punter somehow managed to get through the security and start berating him, that it made big news. Once upon a time, that wouldn't have made big news because the politicians were leaving themselves exposed to that all the time. So it doesn't provide you with an opportunity to see how they react to serious questions from members of the public, because a lot of the questions that the media ask, and I am part of the media, are not the questions that the public want to ask. You know, the public have a very different idea of what's important to them than what maybe some of the media have. And I think that's what's sadly missing from election campaigns now. And I don't know that if you come into an election campaign not knowing who you're going to vote for, that at the end of 6 weeks you're going to be any the wiser. In fact, I doubt that you'll have any idea at all who you're going to put your vote towards.
Yeah, that's true. But Yasmin, we saw today from News Poll there's, I think, 29% of Australians are thinking of voting for an independent or a minor party. They're not putting their preferences with the major parties, at least at the moment. That probably speaks to a level of not having made up their mind, but also a level of disaffection with the sort of pre-digested product that the major parties are putting out there. Is that your interpretation of it?
Yeah, I think so. I think what's also interesting about the independents is that they know their local community well, and it's clear what they can actually do in that space. Whereas I think when we think about the larger parties, it's what are they doing on a wider level. But then as we see with both Albo and ScoMo, I think what they claim and promise to do often falls flat, and that message isn't communicated. So I think what's interesting about the independents is, you know, that idea of transparency, that idea of integrity and restoring trust to politics. And if we see the levels of trust in politics, it is low. It actually went up during the pandemic, which is understandable. We put our faith, our lives in the hands of politicians. But now here we are after the pandemic, and it's pretty disappointing performances across the board. I also think with independents, it's they're not just independents, they're women. And I also think that signals something about the tone shift in this election, that what happened with last year around March for Justice and that movement, that wasn't an anomaly, that wasn't a blip. It triggered something in women to say enough is enough and to mobilize and demand change. Now, in saying that, the independents, you know, even though they are women, they are also wealthy white women, which is, I think, also still a marker of who can get into politics, which is people with time, money, connections. So we still don't really see kind of minority voices in this space, but I still think it's to me something that's exciting and something that should strike a lightning bolt in our election right now to push them outside of the way that we, you know, status quo go about elections. They need to wake up and respond to what's happening now.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Maria. I mean, we see these candidates coming up. They have been independents around, or people running as independents in election campaigns since time immemorial. But there's a different sort of character and quality to what's going on at the moment. It's professional women who have mostly achieved things in their lives already and who are now looking to step into the parliamentary sphere. They're advocating policies that the major parties, in the case of most of these teal independents, that the Liberal Party has not lived up to, and they're saying, well, I'm basically a middle class Liberal voter who feels the Liberal Party has left me, who feels the Liberal Party has abandoned its liberalism. That's making for a pretty compelling message in the current circumstances.
Yeah. I think I would agree with that. And I guess I would add two things. One is if we sort of take a really long kind of view, we sort of see that phenomena in politics can be kind of cyclical, right? So not repetition in the same kind of way, but we sort of see arcs. And the last time we saw, I guess, the groundswell of women choosing to kind of step up and participate in politics was at the sort of tail end of the second wave feminist movement, and many women who had
worked as activists or just for their community decided to move into politics. So they moved into local politics and state politics. We got all those female premiers, for example, out of that, Joan Kerner and Carmen Lawrence and that wave of women. I think what is interesting about this current wave, and I guess what I would add to what Mark has sort of said, is to me it looks like, at the federal level at least, that the moderate faction has effectively lost too many policy battles. You know, you could argue over the last 20 years, but definitely the last 10 years. And there is like a reckoning now, which is, if you think about it, extraordinary. Some of the seats.
This reaches back into sort of John Howard's dominance, yes, of the Liberal Party, doesn't it? And his success, and really just sort of crushed the moderates out of the party.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's actually historically an important point to kind of make, is that John Howard was the first, what we would kind of call a small C conservative leader of the Liberal Party. Prior to that, you know, it was led by what we would kind of call liberals, smaller liberals, or the moderate faction now. And John Howard liked to talk a lot about how he had a broad church, but really, the moderates were generally on the losing side on many policy debates, especially those pointy, sharp ones around asylum seekers, you know. And some of the wins the moderates were able to achieve, for example, getting children out of detention, you know, were important and significant. But the overall architecture of that policy didn't really budge. You know, if you can remove children from protection, that is good. But you still have the whole architecture of the asylum seeker system, in which many moderates, doctors' wives, kind of candidates, these kinds of female candidates who you know, are for integrity and for the environment and so on and so forth, you know, they lost on that. They lost on climate change. They haven't really been able to use their numbers to effectively sort of shift the dial within the Liberal Party. And that's partly to do with the fact that, I guess, they do not use the same kind of aggressive tactics that the far right did, for example, in blowing up several governments over climate change. But we are now at the reckoning where we are facing the situation where the Liberal Party may actually lose seats that they have held since Federation, which is extraordinary.
I wonder if it's, I mean, this gender thing's quite interesting, Yasmin. I wonder if it's about belief as well. I mean, if we think about that process that was happening, even if we go back to those moderates that the prominent moderates from that Howard era, from that early Howard era and before, people like Ian McPhee and Fred Cheney and I suppose Malcolm Fraser to some extent, Andrew Peacock, who was leader, those sort of people just sort of almost have kind of got bludgeoned out of the party in the end. And it was right at the time, or this period sort of coincides with the time when Labor is addressing this gender question and thinking about how does it reframe its rules and eventually in the late 90s adopts affirmative action policies. I wonder if that's kind of, you know, the key driver here for sort of alchemizing the point about losing fights but also representation. So a modern Liberal Party needs to actually represent the community, and the moderates had lost those sorts of arguments and there weren't too many of them left. And we now see the crossbench populated by a number of people who might have been moderates in the Liberal Party at one stage in the past, but now they are sitting firmly on the crossbench. They're outside the party.
God, that's a bloody long question.
It is. Well, that's good for me, really.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I heard murmurs that Peter Dutton would go for it again to try to claim the top seat. And I remember thinking, if that happens, they're losing the election because they are so out of touch with, I think, what the average Australian is thinking and feeling about this. But this is what happens when you're in politics, you're in Canberra, you're in Parliament House. It's funny because if you walk around Parliament, it almost feels like removed from what's happening in the community. It's a different space. And I think if you're in that space 24/7, you start to think that it's just a push and pull between, you know, the moderate and, you know, even more conservative faction, and you lose what is actually happening and what people are thinking and feeling on the ground. And one example of this is the debate around people who are transgender that's happening right now, which I think is frankly such a weird thing that we are hyper fixating on this. And I think what the candidate said, by the way, is wrong. Of course, it's wrong. But you see that even within the Liberal Party, this is what they're focusing on right now. And I find that, you know, it's really interesting. It almost moves it away from where the needle should be in terms of the priority issues that we should be focusing on, and whether that be the COVID recovery, climate change, domestic violence, you can go on. But I think what it does, and we also saw this in the same-sex marriage plebiscite, is that it confuses the message. It means that they don't speak clearly. They speak in very cautious and ambiguous language to appease everybody in the party, and that gets lost in translation. And I think both major parties are guilty of that too.
I wonder whether, though, Australia is now starting to shadow what's happening around the rest of the world. I mean, there's been a definite shift to the right, especially if you look in Europe. I mean, you only have to look at what's happening in France right now. If you look at what happened in Hungary a couple of weekends ago, if you have a look at what's happened in Austria, have a look at what's happened in the UK. You know, there's been a definite shift to the right, and I wonder, you make the very good point about this transgender issue, and I mean, there's very little doubt that this candidate's a, sort of a stalking horse in many ways, that she's been put up. Scott Morrison has said, I don't agree with her, you know, the way that she's phrased it, but I'm not going to shut her down and I'm not going to join the pylon, because I'm sure that he thinks out there in some electorates it's going to win him votes.
So it's a dog whistle in that sense.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I'm sure that that's the way that it's been played. But
it's a pretty high cost one, isn't it? I mean, Warringah was an absolute jewel of the Liberal Party up until Zali Steggall came along.
But I think they've written that off, haven't they? I think they've written Warringah off
if they
for
haven't.
Now.
Well,
they certainly did once they couldn't get the pre-selection stuff sorted, right?
Yeah.
You know, which was a deliberate tactic.
And emblematic of some of the deep problems they've got within. But, yeah, it's quite fascinating to see, because the logic of that is obviously that Warringah itself might be lost, but the controversy around the candidate and the ability to then talk about this issue as if it is a mainstream national concern up there with, you know, cost of living or climate change or you know, the national security, as the government would like to frame it, perhaps less so today. Given
and there are a lot of voters out there who don't want to spend their time crawling through the economy figures, economic figures, etc. But when they hear people talking about hot button issues like this, they do switch on and they think, right, yeah, this is something I feel strongly about. I like what they're saying about it. This is the party I want to support. I mean,
yeah.
It's crass, but it's the way it is.
I'm sure it does appeal to a certain subset of voters, but I wonder how effective it is ultimately when people's everyday lives and their experiences of the cost of living and you know, fears of inflation and interest rate rises, which translate directly in their ability to buy their children shoes and to buy their kids food, whether or not it actually just irritates people. You know, it's like it's not kind of what the average Australian would consider to be the core business of government, which is to ensure that I can get on with my life and my kids will be okay.
But isn't Morrison, in a sense, it's almost like it doesn't really matter what the actual issue is. It's something around which he can make that kind of dog whistle type sort of point that he's made, which is that I won't be part of the pylon. She shouldn't be cancelled. People shouldn't, as you said today, people are tired of walking on eggshells around these issues. I mean, it's all that, you know, John Howard had his own way of talking about this as well, called it political correctness, and in relation to the Indigenous failures, he referred to that as, you know, the black armband view of history and so forth. So this speaks to a kind of a latent, in his construction anyway, a latent but mainstream view.
Well, I think the word dog whistling, like you said before, is the right one. And this is a tried and true tactic in elections to create fear of the other. And this is not the first time. If you look back, it's, you know, fear of asylum seekers, fear of African gangs, fear of Muslims and terrorism. It's the same old thing. And I think we see that on the right is particularly guilty of this method. And if you see a voter who might not be politically engaged and they don't know the facts in front of them, they might see that and think that it is a true threat. So I think that's where that messaging from the left has to be really, really strong and stand firm against that and to call it out for what it is and to not give it the legitimacy and air that they're trying to give it.
It does, I think, if you think about it, kind of put up in lights that he doesn't want to talk about his record.
Yeah, well, that's possibly true.
Or his banjo playing. He doesn't want to.
Ukulele,
was it? Anyway, I can't remember. It was just so good.
just on the Effingham Gangs thing, it made me think of how much I miss Christopher Pyne in the political discourse, because I remember when he was doing a doorstop somewhere and, you know, Dutton had made this point about Effingham Gangs in Melbourne. There was Pyne doing a doorstop in Melbourne and some bright journalist said, Mr. Pyne, are you concerned about going out for dinner tonight? Are you worried about your safety? And he goes, no. Why should I be? And then he's, oh, all the gang thing. Oh, no, I don't worry about that. He completely diffused the whole credibility of the argument. In it was just so humorous.
It was like, that was like when on the first day of the campaign when Albanese stuffed up the figures and someone went to John Howard and his first reaction was, so what?
Exactly.
And then after you got a very important phone call saying, what do you mean, so what? Get back out there and tell them that this is really bad.
This means a lot.
Yes.
He was absolutely right, though. So what?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we'll come back to that. Let's take a quick break there and we'll be back in a moment.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, let's take a question first. Let's start the second half with a question from an audience member, which is not something we can normally do.
My name is Alan. I've also moved from Melbourne, so I know the comments about the Effingham Gangs. I was actually out on dinner that night. I was like, oh, well, I need to go home soon then. It's pretty unsafe, as it was a Friday busy night. Anyway, my question is about, you know, the rise of independent candidates such as, you know, Allegra Spender, Zoe Daniel and all that with Climate 200 and a sort of like kind of challenge to blue ribbon seats. So I guess my question's on the other side. What would it take for an independent candidate to take a red ribbon seat, a safe Labor seat? So for example, in Fowler, they parachuted Christina Keneally in, and now you've got Dai Li, who ran for the Liberals in 2011, running as independent. So what would you think be the factors in trying to, you know, siphon safe Labor voters, especially multicultural communities like myself, being Vietnamese Australian, into kind of winning seats like Fowler, Parramatta, Fraser, Maribyrnong, and all those sort of like really working class places that have become quite gentrified in the last decade or so? Because we hear a lot about Warringah and Wentworth, but what about the other side?
Look, it's a really good question, and obviously if anyone else wants to add to this, but the most celebrated, I think the short answer is it takes an element of surprise, and the most celebrated case of that was Oxley in 1996, where the disendorsed Liberal candidate, therefore running as an independent.
What was her name again?
I'm just coming to that. she won what was, I think at the time, the safest Labor seat in the country. And her name was Pauline Hanson, of course. And she only lasted one term because it's actually, you know, which proves, in a sense, proves the point. She was the exception that proves the rule, really. It is extremely difficult to win in a two-party preferred system in the lower house. And funnily enough, it is those safe seats where it tends to be easier to do than the marginal seats. Like Joe Dyer, for example, who's running in Boothby in South Australia, probably has no chance of winning that seat because it's a 1.4% Liberal seat. So Labor's got a very good, especially if we take the South Australian state election figures, Labor has a very good chance of picking up that seat. The Independent, irrespective of how good she is, probably doesn't have a chance. So it's a really good point that you make there about how it's going, how it's happening in the Liberal Party at the moment and may be successful, Maria, but we don't see it on the Labor side as much.
Yeah, so I think Yasmin kind of put her finger on two of the dimensions as to why we're not seeing this in Labor seats at the moment, like the seat of Fowler, like you suggested. And that is seats, blue ribbon seats, generally have people who are wealthier and it costs a lot of money to be a candidate, even for a major party. And the second is that there tends to be a lot more social capital in wealthier seats. So there are more established groups available which you can kind of draw into your campaign. The final thing that is probably the distinction between, say, what's going on in the Liberal-held seats and Labor-held seats is that the climate issue is sort of the lightning rod that is galvanizing people to some sort of action. And I'm not sure that enough people in seats like Fowler would necessarily be motivated by a lack of representation. It probably would require something, more emotionally important than something kind of abstract like being effectively and descriptively and substantively represented. But, you know, Labor shouldn't worry.
It is interesting, though, that it comes at the end of essentially 9 years of coalition rule. So in a sense, there's a protest element to this that you don't really have pertaining to an opposition as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is
that actually. I mean that in the sense of climate failure,
yes.
Integrity failure, you know, the things that they're campaigning on are things that they say the government could have done but hasn't.
Yes, I mean, I think there's definitely a dimension of people feeling that they've been let down. But I think it has been really interesting to observe the politics of, essentially white people being parachuted into, you know, really diverse multicultural seats where, people who are not white, who have been party members for a really long time, done all the sort of hard yards, all the crap that you do to be a candidate, then being sidelined at the last minute. But whether or not that would translate into an effective independent campaign, I'm not sure all the ingredients are necessarily there. But, you know, I think the days where parties could take things for granted are very much over.
Thank you very much, sir. Let's talk about the tenor of the campaign and the performance of the media. I'm interested to hear all your views on this because there's quite a debate raging, particularly in social media. A lot of strong criticism of the way the opposition leader's inability to recall the unemployment figure was reported, how long that ran in as a story, and I guess. You know, as I said at the start, you know, the performative stuff, the formulaic stuff about election campaigns, you know, all these daily press conferences and so forth. What do you think, Yasmin? What do the people you're speaking to think about this election campaign?
I think people are really tired. I really think they are. I mean, there's this, you know, if you look at the way that the media is reporting on politics right now, it's that minute by minute update. But to me, and this is talking from my lens as a 23-year-old and having friends who have just come out of uni, they're just starting their jobs, they are not following this extremely closely. I think what they are thinking about and what I think isn't being covered effectively in this election is what has been happening in the past few years. It seems like we're focusing so much on what parties are saying and doing right now, but that is not something that builds my trust. It's saying, what have you been saying before and what have you done before? Now, if you know, even if you ask me to identify the key policies that they're running with, I would say the Liberals are focusing, of course, on jobs and employment, and Labor is focusing on care, so Medicare, childcare, aged care. But I couldn't tell you that much in detail about exactly how they're planning to do that. And I think that is quite concerning. Something I also haven't seen, and speaking of what's been happening in the past few years, is we saw major protests led by different groups. So we saw, I mentioned March for Justice, also Black Lives Matter, and also the school strike for climate. And again, from a youth perspective, that's something that we really resonate with, because that isn't something that's happening far away up on the hill. That's something that all our friends participated in, something that was being shared across social media. So, you know, we're focusing on the issues in that regard. And I haven't seen parties acknowledge those kind of debates. And I think they were almost, you know, generational shifting debates about how we understand race and class and gender and climate change too. So I haven't seen a responsiveness from you know, across the board to what's happened in the past few years.
I've been quite critical already so far about the media's coverage of this whole election campaign, but when I think about it a bit more, maybe they're reflecting what the community wants now in terms of, and I say this in that if you go into an editorial meeting now at any newsroom in the country, the most important person in that meeting is normally your social media manager, because they'll come in there and they'll tell you what stories are getting the most clicks on their website and what issues are getting the most likes and shares. And then newsrooms focus their attention based on that. And it's a sad fact that a large percentage of the population now, their only news source now is Facebook or Twitter. You know, people sadly don't go back to the mainstream, or as we said today, the lamestream media, as it was coined in the United States. But I think that's driving a lot of the media coverage now, because for newspapers, they're struggling to remain relevant anyway. And if they don't get hits on their websites, then they're basically going to fade off into the distance and not have any major impact anymore. And they want to have a say. They want to have a sway in this election. So they focus on these hot button issues that they know are going to get hits on their website, and then it sort of generates more and more conversation. Sadly, that comes at the expense of discussing important issues, because it's a fact that I think now that climate change doesn't get hits on the website anymore. I think there's a fatigue factor out there of people talking about it, even though it's probably the most important issue confronting us on the planet right now. It's not a hot button issue during an election campaign.
Does that mean that Scott Morrison has been successful in that strategic shift to net zero by 2050, which seemed risible, frankly, when it happened? I mean, it was, apart from being so horrendously late in the game, they didn't change a single other internal policy setting or program, but it does appear to have effectively neutralized. I'm not saying completely, of course, but it does appear to have substantially neutralized that issue. And Labor has gone a bit further, has a slightly more ambitious approach, but there's not a huge gulf between the two. So,
well, I suspect that the reason why maybe it has less clicks is it's less about the audience appetite and more about how it's framed. And I was looking today actually at both Liberal and Labor's policy around environment, and it was very complex, even just to read it. It was very dense. It used jargon. I was seeing energy mix, electrification, and that might be familiar with older generations. But speaking again from my vantage point as young people, that is not something we know a lot about. And that doesn't mean that we're ignorant. It's just saying that I guess our rhetoric has been more about, you know, things like a carbon tax or things about holding corporations accountable for their, you know, what they're producing and focusing more widely on the planet. So it's also how we're framing this. And if we feed into how both parties are framing the issue, which is very neutral, not focusing on the urgency of the matter, treating it as just, you know, an energy problem, we're missing what's actually happening. So I also think it's the media's role to put those policies in the context of what's going on. And I think climate change is a, you know, pretty scary and urgent issue that we can generate momentum about. Greta Thunberg did that. So it certainly is possible, but not if we use the words that they are using.
Maria, you do a lot of work on political elites, and the media are a former political elite as well that are in this space. How do you see media's performance in contemporary politics, and particularly in the from what we can see so far in this election campaign?
Well, I'm not that impressed a lot of the time, and I guess to go back to this issue of the gaffe, like, I think there's a fair argument to say that you know, it would have been better if Anthony Albanese, if he didn't know the number, could have at least sort of said, told us a story about the rough area of where the number is at, right? And I actually really think that these kinds of gotcha questions are they're ultimately really trivial. If we really want to people who can parrot numbers, we should get rid of elected representatives and we should just get technocrats who are really good at this stuff, right? But we don't. We value electing notionally general people, right? They're not really anymore, but, you know, members of the public to represent us, because we expect the role of a politician to be someone who can listen to the community, represent that community, deal with stakeholders who deal in jargon and technical language, and come and be able to filter that and offer national leadership. And I think that's what is the problem with some of the way that we cover election campaigns and the way that this sort of gotcha kind of politics or coverage of the media really kind of lets us down, because the test the media is setting, you know, like what's the rate of this or what's the rate of that, and both leaders have you know, had stumbles on that. Well, these are really bad proxies, right, for what actually makes a good leader. Being really good in the media, I think we could sort of safely say, given the record of prime ministers from both sides of politics, actually doesn't necessarily translate into good governance, does it? So it is kind of incumbent on the media to think anew about how it is that they more holistically and contextually assess our political leaders. And I put it to you that knowing a figure is neither here nor there. It's
even
trivial.
Even a central figure like that. I mean, we know, right? He knew that the political attack that was coming at him was going to be, you've never held an economic portfolio, you're inexperienced, this is a, you know, multi-trillion dollar economy, we're managing it well, our jobless rate is at a historic low, you can't be trusted with this economy. He knew that was coming at him, right? This was a very predictable question at some point and a key number from the budget only 2 weeks before. It was surprising, and it did feed directly into that government narrative. It says, see, he can't be trusted to run the economy. He doesn't even know how many, you know, what the jobless rate is, even when it's at a historic low.
But does that matter? I mean, did it matter?
I don't think
do
it
we
does.
Care? I mean, do we think he's any worse or likely to be any worse at managing the economy because he didn't have on the top of his head what the unemployment figure was? I mean, I don't know. I mean, yes, you're right. If you want to lead the country, then you probably should have that number at your fingertips. But in the end, I don't know whether people would look at that and go, oh, no, he didn't know that, so I can't possibly vote for him. I don't – I mean, I understand – my understanding
what about the let's flip it around. What about whether it was a fair question? Do you think it was a fair question?
I agree with the about gotcha questions. I mean, I think we
but
all –
would it have
I
been a gotcha all, question if yeah, he'd yeah. answered it correctly? Or would it just not
yeah,
no
but,
one would
but
have known?
What's the point of the question anyway? I mean, well, this is the, what's the? I mean, it's like I think we all cheered. I think we all cheered when Adam Bandt shut down the guy at the press club, because we all thought that's how you deal with gotcha questions. I actually don't see what value they bring to a campaign, and what do they prove about somebody? I mean, we could all sit there, and my understanding was, sorry, Mark, my understanding was that was a three-pronged attack on Anthony Albanese that day. All of them from Murdoch-based media. They'd gone in there and they asked three questions, bang, 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 at him, firing them away at him. And yes, he should have known the answer, but he didn't. And predictably, over the next couple of days, it was in that side of the media, the Murdoch media, that went to town on it. Absolutely went to town on it and said, this guy's not fit to be prime minister. He didn't know the unemployment numbers and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it was a disaster of a day for Anthony Albanese, but in the end, did it sway voters? Do people actually think this is an important thing, or do people think, okay, next time just say Google it, mate?
I mean, I think it was damaging because we're still talking about it. And I think there is a degree of what you were saying, Mark, that is right in the sense that there might be a cohort of voters out there who are looking at Labor and might think, well, yeah, okay, he doesn't know the economic, he doesn't know the cash rate. But, you know, Julie Bishop lost the shadow treasurership because she didn't know the cash rate. But does anyone in this room seriously think she wasn't a good minister? I mean, I think that's kind of the point. You know, she was sort of bundled out of that role because she froze once in an interview. I think she got that figure right. Correct on every single interview she did for the remainder of that day.
And she, I think she says she actually got the figure right, but expressed it as a question mark, and it was the uncertainty which she got crucified for. Yeah,
yeah, and I guess that's my point, right? Like these are ultimately trivial kinds of questions, and it's. I mean, this is where I'd be mean about the media. It's really easy to ask this question. What's actually really hard is to learn about a policy domain.
It's really easy to ask it. Therefore, it's really easy to know that it's coming. I mean, let me just put the other frame of this for a moment, right? You're on an election campaign. You're on a bus. You're taking to these totally orchestrated events. As Ross said before, the members of the public that are there are fully vetted, signed up, you know, well, not signed up, but, you know, totally supportive of they've been pre-vetted and they're there to appear in the pictures. And then you have the press conference and you're not there to do PR for the campaign. You're there to
sell yourself.
Sell
yourself.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, let's be fair. You're there to actually get a story into it and to also test the assertions that are being put forward. When you're the opposition leader and you're saying, I should be the Prime Minister, and the government is saying, well, you know, you can't be trusted. There is a trust question that is a proposition that is being put to voters there. And I mean, the same journalists who asked the question of Albanese had asked the Prime Minister at the press club the price of milk and a litre of petrol and so forth. I mean, that was more gotcha stuff in my view because I don't even know why. I even buy milk and I don't know how much it costs.
But it's sort of trivial.
I didn't even know you don't get it in bottles anymore. Apparently they don't give you milk on your doorstep anymore in a bottle.
But I guess why don't they just boycott the bus? Like, why are they there? If it's all bullshit, why are they there?
Yeah.
Asking bullshit questions. So, yeah. Surely what is important is that the Prime Minister, whoever he or she is, knows how to ask the right questions of officials, knows how to ask the right questions of, you know, interest groups, knows how to balance the needs of the community. Google it is kind of the answer. Or you've got technocrats. They've got thousands of public servants, right?
Can I also raise something that I think the media hasn't been asking about? So it isn't just about, you know, policy is really important, but as you were saying before, it's also about good governance, good character and good leadership. We saw some appalling ways of treating what happened last year around Christian Porter, around Alan Tudge, around a number of staffers that had come forward with some pretty, you know, horrific stories and allegations that wasn't treated with the weight that it deserves. I don't see why we're not looking at the cabinet and at party members more broadly. Why are we just distilling this between Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese, and why aren't we talking about what's actually going on in the parties? I think as voting members of the public, we ought to feel like there are good people representing us. I don't know if we can say that right now.
Well, that's a very good point. It actually raises a question that I was going to come to. I think we're getting very close to time here, but I would be interested in getting your views about whether young people as a cohort particularly and women as a cohort are going to be decisive in this election. But I'll let you think about that. We'll take this one question and then we'll come back to that.
G'day, my name is Jeff. Congratulations on your double century.
Thanks. I nicked a couple, but, you know.
Yeah, went down to third man quite often. Today China announced the security deal with the Solomon Islands. Does the panel think that this is a monumental stuff up in foreign affairs, and how will it play out in the election?
That's a really good question, Jeff. I personally think it is a monumental stuff up. It was meant to be called a Pacific step up, but they've managed to turn it into a stuff up. But I think it's an interesting question because it does that rare thing of injecting foreign affairs, foreign policy into a domestic election campaign, which doesn't happen much in Australia. And I do think it shows a pattern of a government that has not been really. I mean, it bangs on about the China situation, the national security atmosphere. We sort of hear about it all the time, and yet some key development was happening in our supposed backyard, as we like to call it, and the government was sitting on its hands. And then when it did find out about it, It sent a couple of officials there first. Then eventually it sends reluctantly a junior minister who's not even in cabinet and who most people, I mean, in ACT we've heard of him, but most of the rest of Australia wouldn't know him from Adam. And I don't think that spoke to a great deal of urgency, but does anyone else want to contest me on that?
Well, I think it also just highlights the what is the sort of result of our decade of climate wars. You know, what's the number one security issue in the Pacific? Climate change, because there might be no Pacific islands left, right? And perhaps that's why we might have seen the lack of action that you've highlighted.
It is a tough area for for one government to try and intervene or to, I mean, how far do they go?
Well, they could have sent the foreign minister. That wouldn't have been that outrageous.
But even if, even the foreign minister, I think when you're taking on China, with all great respect to the foreign minister, I don't know that would have changed the outcome.
No, but why did they send Seselja in the end? They sent him because Kurt Campbell was going there from the US and it would have looked ridiculous that Australia hadn't even managed to get a ministerial-level visit there, you know, to sort of try and correct the situation. But in the end, whatever strategy they adopted didn't work. Jeff, I'm going to give you a very quick second bite.
Yeah, just a comment that it was an announcement by China. There was no signing ceremony. There was no leader from the Solomon Islands. In the ceremony, it was just announced. So, you know, that says a lot.
Yeah, well, exactly. And it's an information details-free environment, this. But, yeah, it's a fascinating development in this. And it would be funny or fascinating to watch how it plays out because at one level it speaks to, you know, that sort of pattern of the government being slow to act and arguably government incompetence. At another level, if you flip it around the other way, if Australians don't bother about the details too much, and a lot of voters won't, they'll just see it as evidence that the government is right, that the China security situation is perilous and therefore we need to stick with the government we've got. So I don't know which way that that issue will play out.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, it's the details. It isn't walking in the US's shadow. And I think that from a foreign policy standpoint, we tend to do that a lot.
Yeah,
and that's where we're gearing.
Really increased it.
That's where we're looking towards. We've got our blinders, we've got our blinkers on. We can't see what's happening around us. And then this result, you know, this result happens.
We've come a long way from the country that was finding its security in Asia rather than from Asia. And now we sort of see this retreat to the Anglosphere. And, you know, that's what AUKUS was all about. And it's funny today hearing government ministers saying, you know, this doesn't seem to be very transparent. Well, what was transparent about the AUKUS switch? Tell you what, Macron, who happened to be a security partner at the time, didn't know bugger all about it, as we saw. Now, look, we're going to have to wrap up
here.
Wouldn't
it be good, Mark, to have a prime minister that speaks fluent Mandarin right now?
Indeed.
Apparently he's going to Washington, though, or is he?
Yeah, except that he's not.
Yeah, exactly.
Or he says he's not. I don't know. Mm. Anyway, just a quick one. Do you think what do you think, Yasmin, on the youth vote, for example? Do you think there's a lot of young people have come onto the roll? I think there's a few hundred thousand have come on in the last 7 days. Most of those would be young people coming onto the roll for the first time.
Yeah, and I absolutely hope that they use their vote and they use their voice. I think, though, as I said about trust, you know, my generation has the lowest levels of trust in our political system. And it's little wonder why, when the way that we talk and interact is, you know, like I mentioned, through social media and through, you know, very different from these almost very ancient, archaic feelings of the way that this election is even being handled. But I think it's really important. I watched Scott Morrison's campaign video, the one he did on the just before he announced the election. And it was pretty gross that he started mentioning young people as a tool of hope. I don't know if you saw it, but he was saying, I went to a trade school and I asked young people who wants to start a business and half of the room put their hands up. That's why I love Australia. And I'm like, what have you done for young people one time when you were government? And I think that's the thing, where young people are used as tools of hope, but not actually giving young people the value and weight they deserve. And on that topic of women, I was looking at the approval ratings during March for Justice last year. So when that was happening, approval ratings went down from 62 to 57 in Morrison's favour, and it dropped by 10% in women. So whereas with men, it didn't actually move at all, which is another interesting point. So I certainly think the women's vote as well could make a substantial impact.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating, isn't it, Ross? Because you remember that Wayne Goss comment years ago when he said that voters were waiting for Paul Keating and Labor with baseball bats, you know, on the verandas. They were, in other words, they were quite determined to get rid of the government. I suppose that's an unknown question about this election. Have all of these stories, the ones that Yasmin's just referred to, changed sort of almost quietly and in a way that we haven't yet seen the electoral expression of, the view of a significant number of people in the electorate, many of them women?
Yeah, and I don't know that women would feel at this stage that they've been particularly taken notice of. I mean, we've got four leaders now, all four main political party leaders are all men, which is basically the status quo. It's been like that for a long time with occasional rare blips. And one of the things about this election campaign is that, and I don't know whether it was the same in the last election campaign because I wasn't here for it, but everything is covered live now. Like,
yeah,
they go out on the hustings and every press conference they do. And I've noticed that at each press conference, the leader, whether it's Albanese or Morrison, they always have one of their senior female leaders or female ministers or shadow ministers next to them. And Katie Gallagher was there in the early days standing alongside Albanese. But I don't know that that's enough. I don't think that's cutting it. I think we're not hearing the voice of women and we're not seeing enough women talking in this campaign about what's important for this very significant part of the electorate. And I worry that we're going to get to the end of this election campaign and I feel a little bit sorry for these young people who've waited for years possibly to come and finally have their chance to have their say, and they're greeted with this palaver. Mm. And they're thinking, my God, what was all the fuss about? What's in this for me? I can't see anything in here that excites me about climate change or any of these big issues. So where do I go? And can I please withdraw my name from the electoral roll?
And also, can I mention there was a recent study by Plan International Australia found that 59% of young women don't even think that Parliament is safe or has believed that it became more safe in the past year. So let that be a reflection on where our democracy is right now.
Yes, it's a fascinating detail that. Maria, Judith Brett wrote very persuasively about Bob Menzies' appeal to the women of Australia in The Forgotten Australians and that whole pitch to women as homemakers of the sort of silent middle class and so forth. I wonder if the bookend of that is that women are going to be walking away from the Liberal Party in significant numbers now.
Well, increasingly we know that women who used to be a stronghold of the conservative vote have, across the world, moved more to the left. I think it is actually kind of interesting that so much of the subtext of, I guess, what Scott Morrison has been saying to Australian women is kind of along the lines of, I know I'm a bullhead, but, you know, I'm really trying. And I do wonder how
was
many...
Was that a slogan? Was that a campaign slogan?
Well, I'm sure they'll call. And I do wonder how many exhausted women from the pandemic really will give him another go.
Just on that, Mark, unless I've missed something, I've not seen anything in the first 10 days of the campaign about the pandemic. I've not seen any discussion about how it was handled, where we go from. It just seems to have been pushed to one side.
Mm.
I'm really
it's bizarre.
No, it's a really interesting point. Just back on that slogan thing, it reminded me of that slogan of New South Wales Labor some years ago that was, I think it was, more to do but moving in the right direction.
That's inspiring.
Yeah, we've done nothing but give us a chance to just have another crack at it, please.
Yeah. Look, that's Democracy Sausage again for another week. Thanks to Yasmin Poole, Ross Solly and Dr. Maria Teflaga. And thank you for bearing with us for this slightly longer recording. I just couldn't cut it off because the conversation was so interesting. Can I also take a moment to acknowledge and thank Jack Fox and other people doing the technical work here today. Jack is with us in the studio every week and does sterling work there, so fantastic assistance from him. Also from Angus Blackman, who is the EP, the executive producer of Democracy Sausage, who couldn't be here because he's had to isolate, speaking of COVID. Also like to thank James Gigaher and his team who wrangled all of the arrangements that needed to be done to make this happen. I'd like to also pick out and make a special thanks to Martin Pierce, who is over here. He may stand up if I can convince him to do so. Martin was the original EP of Democracy Sausage and the driving force behind making it happen, and he made sure that I was there every week. He insisted that, you know, to make a podcast work, you have to come out at the same time every week. He even had me doing two podcasts a week for quite a long time until I realized that I was getting almost nothing else done. But Martin's no longer here. He's doing some other things, but an absolutely crucial figure in the development of this podcast. And I'd also like, just on that frame, to thank Professors Paul Pickering, Sally Wheeler, Helen Sullivan, and, of course, the Vice-Chancellor, Professor Brian Schmidt, all of whom have really backed this podcast all the way through. And it's a significant part of the university's outreach. And we really thank you for your enthusiasm for being here tonight for this 200th episode, which is, you know, quite an achievement. So thanks very much.
Thank you for listening.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.